The following may contain offensive language, adult humor, and or content that some viewers may find offensive. The views and opinions expressed by any one speaker does not explicitly or necessarily reflect or represent those of Mark Rattledge or W2M Network. Please listen with caution, or don't listen at all.
TV party tonight! TV party tonight!
Oh, we got nothing better to do than watch TV and have a couple of brews.
Don't want to talk about anything else.
We don't want to know.
We're dedicated, yes,
to our favorite shows.
Oh, my circuit!
Everybody loves Hypnotoad!
Gary Dawg!
Larson at Blurnville!
Futurama!
Hello, good evening, and welcome to TV Party Tonight. I am your host, Alexis Haina, and tonight, you better be ready for a long climb up to Mount Olympus, because we are talking Percy Jackson and the Olympians, the newest series that has debuted on Disney+, which is also the second adaptation of the uber-popular young adult series written by Rick Riordan. I wanted to make absolutely sure I got this guy's last name right. And joining me, one of my fellow cohorts of the Unholy Trinity, Mr. Jason Teasley. Hello.
Hey, how's it going? Glad to be on the show. I know that we were supposed to have some other esteemed guests that life got in the way, but I'm glad to be here filling in to take us through this mystical journey.
Well, it's hard to get people to commit when Mark doesn't pay us. Sorry, something in my throat. All right. So, yes, like I said, this is the second adaptation of the popular book series. The first films came out. When the hell did the book series come out here? I should probably have looked that up. The first film came out in 2010. Second film, Sea of Monsters, came out in 2013. There it is. Yeah, it's like, excuse me, I should have prepped that page. No, I'm sure I have that committed to memory. So, Mr. Teasley, go ahead and tell us. You seem pretty adamant about joining me on tonight's discussion. What about Percy Jackson really got you? Because you told me you haven't read the books.
I have not read the books. Well, first and foremost is I have an uncanny love for Greek mythology. Dates all the way back to when I was born. My mother's father, my grandfather, actually named me Jason after Jason of Argonauts from the Greek adventure of The Search for the Golden Fleece, which was the great-grandson of Hermes, which we all know is the god of travelers. So that kind of sparked my interest in Greek mythology. But then the first two movies came out, and with my love for Greek mythology, I kind of stumbled upon them. And against other opinions, I actually like the two Percy Jackson movies. I actually enjoyed them. I have not read the books, but there's a lot of things that I do know about the books that we'll discuss as we touch on this Disney Plus series that differ not only from the movie but also the TV series. So it's the love for the Greek mythology, all of that just mystical realm of gods and goddesses and mystical beast that, you know, basically I'm the non-D&D loving, mystical beast loving creature here, closet creature here on the Rattledge Broadcasting Network.
Yeah, isn't like a love of D&D one of the prerequisites nowadays to get a job recording with us?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't love D&D. I'm sorry, Ronnie, but I'm not a big... I played D&D. I played a couple of D&D adventures back in my youth, and that makes me sound old, which I am. But, yeah, I'm not
None
like
of us
a,
are that young. We're a bunch of crotchety old...
Yeah.
White people,
yell at
yelling at our TV screens.
Yeah, I yell at clouds, and I speak back in the good old days when I walked uphill both ways barefoot and 4 feet of snow. But I've always been fascinated with like the mystical creatures and the just the lore of the Greek mythology and the gods and goddesses and the different pantheons of the Greek mythology. Back to the very first introduction to Greek mythology I ever had was the old 80s version of Clash of the Titans. So that was actually my true introduction into Greek mythology, and it just grew from there, which is really weird because that was did not age well. but it was something near and dear to me, and it began my love of the Greek mythos.
All right. Yeah, see, I got in love with the Greek mythos through a book series that was available at my middle school library, which focused on all of the different mythological monsters. Remember, there was one for Cerberus, one for the Sphinx, one for the Sirens, and it was just very fascinating to me, and I kept reading them, and I love them. Okay, thank you, Canvas Content. So really like that. So yeah, I've always been a big fan also of Greek mythology. I did read the first book. It was a little young for me. Again, we're way too freaking old for this. It was clearly the young adult was a little younger than I was. I was babysitting my younger cousins. They had the first book, so I read it, devoured it in like a day and a half. And it intrigued me, but admittedly not enough to read the rest of the books. But I was very intrigued by this adaptation that Disney Plus was doing. It's a salute. It's like, I couldn't even tell. It's like, what is that emoji?
I thought it was a banana.
I thought it was a banana too. Admittedly, that does not show up well against a white background. Yeah. But yes,
yeah.
Back to you too, Canvas Content. Because the first book, you're entitled to like the first film, but a lot of Percy Jackson fans really did not like the film adaptations that came out. Among other reasons, Riordan was pretty much locked out of the studio. He was not allowed to give creative content or to ask for anything. So obviously there were a lot of changes. I think the most famous one that people complained about was the ages. Percy Jackson and his friends are supposed to be the youngest of teenagers, 12, maybe 13. We got Logan Lerman as Percy, who looks 17, 18 at the potential youngest in this film. So definitely aiming a little high there. And I know, yes, it's common for us to age up our actors in films, but it still just feels very out of place to have someone that old who is supposed to be going through what Percy Jackson is going through. It doesn't really add up, in my opinion.
Well, and the fact that, you know, I in some aspects, them aging him up worked. In some aspects, it didn't. It was kind of, it would have pros and cons to it, like, in certain aspects, moving the story along. But overall, I do see where people had the gripe. Like I said, I wasn't really familiar with the source material of the book. So I was indifferent. I was just kind of along for the journey. So I did have that really emotional connection to the character. So I was just going with the journey and seeing how everything played out.
Yeah. So again, this series got its green light on Disney Plus, and Riordan basically said, okay, fine. You want to make an adaptation? Well, then guess what? You are going to let me be involved. And I think based on what we have seen from adaptations of books, manga, and the like over the years, unless it's Stephen King, having the creator heavily involved in the process of adaptation is a good thing.
Yeah, because you get not only the fan service, you get a really close adaptation, and you get some of the key elements that make the story genuine to the audience that either grew up with it or you're trying to latch onto and bring them into. So you get your core audience as well as a really close representation with having the creator to have their ability to keep their hands and fingerprints on the adaptation, which we're going to see how that really pans out with the Harry Potter series that's going to be coming out soon.
That is going to be interesting. But yeah, looking at what we've seen with some past adaptations that we have reviewed on this show, including The Last of Us, House of the Dragon, even the One Piece adaptation, they have all included the original creators in the writing process, gotten a feel for what they really wanted to stick to. And I think it has shown a lot of really great material over the years. I make the Stephen King joke, and it only laughs if you have had the misfortune of sitting through the Shining TV miniseries that came out, which Stephen King basically sat down and said, I don't care what you do as long as it's loyal to the book. Because that's the only thing positive you could say about that.
And that's a very low bar to clear.
Yeah, pretty much. All right. So starring as Percy Jackson, we got Walker Scobell. Some of you may have recognized him from films like The Adam Project and Secret Headquarters. I thought he did a really good job as Percy. He gives a very... He is the audience's eyes. He is the one who is new to all of this. But it is not overwhelming. He is not constantly giving the mystified enchantment, the oh my god look. He seems to really be able to keep himself grounded throughout the series. Really enjoyed his performance. I think we're going to see a lot out of this kid as he gets older.
Yeah, and he did a very good job. And what's a lot of feedback that I've heard, and we'll explore this a little bit more, is the core three. A lot of backlash came with the casting of the core three, a lot of changes that were made from the book.
Let's get this out of the way. In the books, pretty sure Annabeth wasn't black.
No. But in my research, yes, I actually, for the first time, so mark this down, I actually did research for this show because I was doing it with you. So that's why I did my research, you know. They actually said that some of the reasoning why they did the character change, it wasn't for keeping it so much to the source material. It was for the fact that your three protagonists have such a great chemistry on screen that they just worked well off of each other. Through the auditions and everything, these three characters just kind of clicked together, and that's kind of where they went with it. It wasn't like, you know, trying to diversify anything. It was just simply because they had the best chemistry, and that's where everything landed. And I know with a lot of today, you know, you have the diversity angle pushed, and you know, and that's where a lot of backlash came. But like I said, when I was watching some stuff, I was looking at the differences from the book and everything. They said that the chemistry through the auditions was just uncanny. They said that it just came off literally like three best friends ready to go on an adventure together. And when they screen test with other people, it just didn't click. There just was something that fell off. And that's where they kind of landed with these three protagonists that you find yourself with throughout the series. And, you know, because sometimes you can stray away from the source material and still get a great product. And I think this is one of those instances where you get a great core protagonist all the way around, and the characters take you out of that, you know, have to be, you know, really hard sticking to character design and everything from the book because of the performances they get and the chemistry you see on screen.
Very much so. And yeah, you could make the argument that there was a push for inclusivity, but the fact is that these three actors really did come together. They really did well. What is the name of the actress here? Leah Sava Jeffries as Annabeth, and you have Aryan Simhadri as Grover. They are just so perfect together. So, and for the record, the race thing with Annabeth, again, she's described in the book, I believe it's blonde hair and gray owl-like eyes was the phrase that was used. But frankly, none of those are crucial to the plot. They are a description in the book, but it's not like somebody remarks later about her gray owl-like eyes and it's a plot point. So I have no problems with the diversity and the inclusivity and the race changing. Again, the actress was really great.
Yeah, and I could understand if the characterizations, you know, were really plot driven. They really played into certain aspects of the plot that had to be there. But, you know, this doesn't do that. So swapping things out and just getting the chemistry, I felt, was more important than, you know, the true to description that the book gave off, rather than, you know, seeing the chemistry come across the screen.
Very much so. It is also really hard to get kid actors who are able to pull off stuff like that. Again, that's another reason why a lot of characters are aged up if they're younger in the original source material. Younger kid actors are just, it's very hard to work with them, not to mention there are tons of labor laws that keep you can't act, you know, keep them on set for so long. I think my favorite example of that was the original Interview with the Vampire film, because Claudia in the book is like 4 or 5, something like, she is little. She's a little girl. And it's like, you cannot get a child that young to pull off the performance that a character that Claudia needs. You have to age her up. And so we got Kirsten Dunst, who was obviously a lot older than that, and she did great.
Yeah, and, you know, and this goes back to us talking about the movies, when they aged them up in the movies, because a movie versus a TV series has a very different, you know, you and Dorian can attest to this. Shooting a movie, you can be on set for vastly longer than you would be shooting the episode of a television show. And yes, generation of child performers. Yes. But, you know, you can, doing a film is much more grueling on actors than doing a television show, because you have those breaks, you have that downtime more so on a television show. Doing a movie, you have longer days on set, you have much tighter time constraints and everything. So, you know, you run into, like you said, labor laws and everything. So it's a whole different beast you're trying to tackle in the realm TV versus film.
All right, well, let's go ahead and get to the plot. This is an adaptation of the first book, Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief. We have our 12-year-old Percy Jackson, who is a troubled young student. He has what he thinks is dyslexia and ADHD. He's been kicked out of a couple of schools, has trouble focusing, only to learn that he is, in fact, a demigod. He is half human, half Greek god. And he learns this when he is attacked by his teacher, who is in fact a harpy in disguise, played brilliantly by Megan Mullaney. and he is sent off to Camp Half-Blood, where fellow demigods are taught how to survive, and they are also protected. It isn't long before we find out he is specifically the son of Poseidon, god of the sea, which is admittedly also a big no-no, because the three big gods on Olympus, Zeus, Poseidon, and Hades, had sworn to stop fathering children. Because I think they mentioned in the book the last time they did that, we got World War II.
No, it was the children started becoming so overpowered that they had to end the bloodline, because everything was the children was becoming rampantly and overpowering. And what you're thinking of is what started World War II, was the last war.
Right.
Among the gods, and there was two forbidden children. There was Percy, and I think her name was Thalia
was the daughter of Zeus, who could not be saved, and so Zeus, in very much a classic Greek tragedy, Zeus turned her into a tree, but that tree became essentially set up the barrier for Camp Half-Blood. Demigods, this is not going to be the first time I mess up and use Harry Potter terminology here, folks.
Well, sorry. I mean, they're half-bloods. I mean, they're still half-bloods.
Yeah, but still, it's like they don't use the term half-bloods. And I'm pretty sure it's specifically because they don't want to be like, wait, half-bloods? You mean pure-bloods? You mean, there's a lot of crossover potential there. Yeah.
Which actually we'll talk about a Harry Potter crossover once we get to a certain scene.
Very much so. All right. So, yes, Percy ends up at Camp Half-Blood after seeing what his mother tries to get them there after they are attacked by a Minotaur and Tidy Whities. I don't know if that was a design choice or if someone at Disney literally said, put a pair of underpants on the Minotaur before the censors go after us. I don't know.
Yeah, because we don't need to see Minotaur Donk.
No, we don't.
But yet, Donald Duck still doesn't have pants.
Go Pig. Yeah, they're just Porky Pig. What are you going to do? Yeah. The laws of who can and can't wear pants will forever just be, you know, no, it's not black and white, it's gray. So his mother tries to save him, and she, what looks like, is killed by the Minotaur, in which Percy actually slays the Minotaur in revenge. He is now at Camp Half-Blood. He is being trained. He is claimed by Poseidon after a very ugly game of capture the flag. And he is told, well, guess what? You get to go on a quest. Because we're obviously not just going to have a popular young adult series where he's stuck in the cabin the whole dang time. And the quest is, someone has stolen Zeus's master bolt. The MacGuffin, we'll call it. And they believe it's Hades. Because, unfortunately, these guys have paid way too much attention to Hollywood's interpretation of Hades and not enough to the actual Greek myths. Hades isn't Satan. Hades isn't evil. Sorry, that's something we'll talk about a little bit later when we're talking about more of the characters. But that has always been just a thorn in my side with a lot of film adaptations.
Yeah.
Except for Disney's Hercules. They get a pass because James Wood was hilarious.
Yes. Hades in Hercules, voiced by James Wood, is probably one of the best performances ever.
Absolutely. So Percy has to go on a quest to go down to the underworld. Is it literally go to hell, find the master bolt, and return into Mount Olympus? Otherwise, Zeus and Poseidon are going to start a war, because Zeus is pretty sure that Percy took it for no other reason than essentially looking at his brother saying, oh yeah, you would just love to have your sons, love it if your son was the one who stole it. This family needs therapy. But again, Greek gods need therapy. Understatement of the, I don't even want to say millennia, of eternity.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you follow Greek mythology, and if you do your Greek mythology lesson, Greek mythology is really, really screwed up. The gods are totally screwed up. They are basically egomaniacs who try to one-up each other to boast and just basically be the one to overthrow Zeus.
They are creatures of pure emotion. There's no logic. There's no sitting loyalty. Down and discuss. You know, it is they do. It's like, I'm angry. You're going to die. I love you. You're going to bore my child. It just, that is it. They have no restraint, no limits. Well, because they're gods.
And yeah, there's no bounds. I guess the easiest way to put it, there's no bound limit. It's limitless. The mm-hmm. boundaries don't exist, and things are limitless because who can tell a god no? Is basically the what it boils down to. And they are very backstabbing, and they always try to one up each other. And there's a lot of rivalries and sibling rivalries and everything that you learn about through this. And as you progress through this, you see the big three, Poseidon, Zeus, and Hades, are only two of them have an ego. And it's not the one you expect.
Absolutely.
Hades is the one that is just happy to exist in his own little world, in the underworld. He does not want to be involved with the rest of Mount Olympus. Zeus and Poseidon want to battle for control of Mount Olympus, and they are constantly at war with each other, and they're trying to one-up each other in a sibling rivalry. And therein lies where Percy comes in, because of a jealousy. Zeus thinks that Percy, who is basically the bastard child of Poseidon, stole it because Poseidon is jealous and wants to overthrow Zeus, hence the rivalry and the animosity and the tension between them. So
I don't think they ever really established, I could be wrong, but I don't think they ever really established that Poseidon wants to overthrow Olympus. It genuinely would not surprise me if Hades, I guess Hades is a Hufflepuff. He's pretty much just like, I'm content down here. No problems. But it would not surprise me if the concept is just anytime something goes wrong, Zeus is immediately quick to point his fingers at Poseidon, and Poseidon's just too stubborn to step down and say, and be just like, yeah, think what you want to think. Okay. I don't want to deal with your bullshit. You know?
Because, well, and that goes back to something that's said in here, the sea cannot be contained.
Very much so.
And that goes along with Poseidon. If you a sea in a storm is raging and everything, it's pure emotion. It is everything, and it will not back down. You cannot control it. And that is exactly where the rivalry between Zeus and Poseidon come from, is Zeus might be the head, quote unquote, of the gods, but Poseidon doesn't seem like this. Poseidon sees him as an equal, not a superior.
Mm-hmm.
And that pisses Zeus off more than anything, because everybody else sees Zeus as a superior, except for Hades and Poseidon. They see him as equal. Hades really just don't give a damn, because Hades is just content.
Mm-hmm.
He's content, peaceful. But Poseidon is like, you're no better than me. We're equal. And that pisses Zeus off. And that's where the animosity comes from on Zeus' side.
Well, we have our three main characters. Percy, he is sent off with Annabeth, who we talked about earlier. She is a daughter of Athena. And Grover, who is not a demigod, he's a satyr. He is a satyr protector. Apparently, the satyrs are tasked with protecting the demigods. And it was his task to make sure that Percy got to camp unharmed. And he succeeded. And Percy insists that Grover come with him on this quest because he believes that Grover is so true of a friend that he would, you know, trust his life with him. There's also the fact that he has been given the official quest via an oracle who dropped a little hint that the one you call friend will betray you. And that's the other reason he chooses Annabeth, is that they don't really like each other. He's like, well, you're not my friend, so I don't have to worry about you betraying me. And Grover, who he adores just too much, saying, I know you won't betray me. So they're off. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
And that puts up some seeds of distrust at the start of this. When that is, because you're of course there's going to be spoilers, because you kind of don't see the one that calls friend that will betray him is actually somebody that has been mentoring him while he's been in Camp Hapla to prepare him for this quest, basically getting him ready, working on his swordsmanship, basically befriending him. And you don't figure that out. And you mentioned earlier, you know, Percy in the books does have severe ADHD and dyslexia simply because he is a demigod and he is the Greek mythology is he sees everything from a Greek perspective rather than a quote-unquote English perspective. That's why he has the dyslexia and the ADHD, because he sees the world differently, which is really interesting.
I think they say that the ADHD is kind of like just heightened senses that are not properly trained, so to speak.
Which is really cool because, I mean, you know, a lot of things here. I suffer from dyslexia.
I didn't know that, actually.
Yeah, you've seen me type.
I have a lot of friends who suck at typing. It's not due to dyslexia. It's just due to them failing typing class.
But, yeah, the dyslexia and the ADHD is something that a lot of people struggle with. And seeing the representation on screen is kind of nice to see, and not showing it as basically a setback is kind of seeing it as a quote unquote, I want to say superpower, but something different that makes you stand out rather than exclude you from everything.
All right. Well said. So we have our three heading off to the entrance to the underworld, which is in Los Angeles, because of course it's in Los Angeles. That's where everything goes to die. And we get our little adventure along the way. One of the things I really liked about the way the book was constructed was that it's very similar to the original story of the Odyssey. You know, it is very much, they get out of one scrap and they think they have found a safe spot, but guess what? It's another scrap. And that is very much so, again, like the story of Odysseus, like, okay, let's get to he's trying to get home. It's like, okay, let's go to this island. Oh no, a monster. Quick, let's get out of here. Okay, we're all right. Hey, let's go to this other beach. Oh no, there's another monster. And that is literally what happens to Percy. Every time they think they have found a place they can be safe or a place they can rest or something, there's another freaking monster or Greek legend or whatever there to kill them. Not only because they're demigods and we've established that demigods are not safe in the world, but because now Zeus thinks that since he stole the Master Bolt, he has essentially called all of his monsters saying, see that kid? Go kill him.
Yeah, basically put a bounty on him to find out why, to bring the Master Bolt home back to Mount Olympus, as well as eliminate Percy for being the Forbidden Son.
So we have our first stop, but this actually does bring me to a point that I want to make about the series that admittedly I was not a fan of. And that is, multiple times in the story, the kids figure out what the problem is before the problem even starts. Prime example is this first encounter where it is, what is it called? Auntie M's
Gnome Emporium.
Garden Gnome Emporium, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, mythological base of Australia. Everything's trying to kill you. No kidding. In the book and in the original, and that first film adaptation, they don't realize what it is until it's just like a little too late. Here, they walk in, they see all the stone statues of monsters and everything, and they're just like, it's Medusa, of course. And that is something that comes up multiple times. There are many points in the story where the kids find out, just a few minutes too late, they've stumbled into a trap. And I'm not a fan of that. It's like, first of all, I think that takes out kind of the suspense. Sorry, it's on my throat there. That goes along with, again, these, we're looking through with the eyes of these kids. We're seeing them, and the idea of them realizing, wait, something is wrong, I feel adds a lot to the suspension and the excitement. Going in, realizing this is a trap, it kind of just cuts the feet out from underneath us. It really takes a lot out of it.
Yeah, and the way they handled Medusa, I'm iffy on. I like how they handled her as a tragedy, because Medusa, the story of Medusa is very tragic and very heartbreaking. But they made her be like this really sympathetic person, but then at the drop of a hat, she turns into this sinister. I think they should have played it up that she kind of played more toward the whims and befriending the kids before trying to do it. I think the turn should have been a little bit slower. And they could have expounded on that, which I think that they could have just added maybe another 5 minutes to that episode just to kind of see her slowly turn a little bit more, and not as abruptly. But the deal with Medusa, I think they handled it in the movie a little bit better than they did here. And that's just my personal opinion, so don't come at me.
I will say I like this design of Medusa more, and I really like the idea of the veil hiding the eyes, because so often nowadays, the concept of the Gorgon, if we see a Gorgon in modern day, she's wearing sunglasses. The veil, I thought, was a very creative touch.
Yeah, and it's more elegant, and it which is what Medusa was. Medusa was a very beautiful lady, and just that veil and the hat and the veil brings a level of elegance to her, and as well as keeps with her story, because she was very beautiful, and you know, she was basically cursed because goddesses are assholes. But
yeah, you realize there are some versions of that story where it wasn't a romantic coupling where Poseidon just convinced Medusa to sleep in Athena's temple. There have been many where Poseidon took her and Athena did a little bit of victim blaming, which also brings to light a line that this Medusa says when Percy says, well, if you're not a monster, what are you? And she says, I'm a survivor. You know, that hits a lot differently depending on your interpretation of the original myth.
Yeah, and that's something that with Greek mythology you find a lot of. You find a lot of different interpretations, different stories, different tellings, and you don't and you get to pick and choose which one you want to. It's basically choose your own adventure with Greek mythology on some of the backstories. And you kind of
except that you don't get to go back because you kept your thumb on the page.
And you get to pick what resonates with you the most, what speaks to you the most, what backstory that you connect with more. And that's you see that in a few adaptations here, most notably Medusa, also Hades, when we get to talk to him about him a little here in a little bit. His backstory in this is a little bit tweaked from what it actually is, because there's a line that he says that is kind of makes Hades' story more tragic in real life, but in this it's kind of turned out. But yeah, some of the things, some of the quote unquote adventures seem like really rushed, because you just kind of pop into places and you don't really see it. It's kind of like you're rushed to get to the next god, goddess, or mythical creature interaction.
Very true. Speaking of which, we next after they... Okay, I do have to talk about this, actually. We're not going to discuss in great lengths every single adventure that they go on in this series, because if we're doing that, then we're pretty much just talking episode by episode, and we try to avoid falling into that trap. But I do want to talk about one thing, and that is how they kill Medusa, because I have never seen such a blatant attempt to keep the PG-13 rating on a series. In the book, Percy calls back to his namesake and uses, I can't remember what it is. It's like an ornament or a glow. It's something shiny. And he uses the reflection to wait for Medusa to get behind him and swings behind him. Again, this is a callback to the classic myth where Perseus uses a very shiny shield and waits for Medusa to get in range and then swings and kills her. This one, Annabeth puts the cap, we're just going to call it the cap of invisibility. I know it's got another name, but screw it. That's what I'm calling it, on her. And he swings, which I'm sorry, I honestly thought it was the stupidest thing in the world. It's like, well, now you're just swinging at an invisible target. Get back to me when that makes any sense. And he decapitates her, and he's miming, holding the invisible head with the helm on it. And like I said, it's like, okay, I get it. It's Disney. We can't have blood on screen. We have talked before on this show about how hilarious it is the way certain creators will go out of their way to avoid antagonizing the MPAA. But that was just so... I'm sorry. There has to have been a different way to do that without having blood on screen, because it just looks so stupid.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was very, very outlandish, I guess you could say. Because then you got to try to figure out which way you're going to point Medusa's head, and it's invisible, so you've got to try to figure out what way to point it.
I would have loved when he goes out to kill Electo again, if he'd pull it, it's like, whoops, pulled it the wrong way, zip, 420'd.
Yep.
Get back to me if you catch that reference.
Yeah, I got it. But yeah, it would have been interesting. But some of the...
For the record, good callback. Samurai Jack found ways to avoid showing blood on screen until Adult Swim got to do the final season. So very good callback there, Canvas Content. That is absolutely true. I need to go watch that series again.
I've never seen it.
Oh, it's. Do you have HBO Max? It's so good. It's on there.
Yeah.
You should watch it. If for no other reason, Robert and I will quit harassing you about it.
Robert harasses me about a lot of things.
Okay, we'll harass you about something different, okay?
Okay. But I think the Medusa thing was really nice and handled well. The St. Louis thing, I didn't like how it was handled. Outside of when Percy falls in the water, and you get the instructions to see his father. The only other thing, you know, I mean, you have the going through there, the interaction with Ares was really fun. The Carnival episode was really fun, and the whole throne to retrieve the shield and them appealing to get Percy out of the chair was fun.
Even though I want to talk about that when you're done, because I didn't think that trap made any sense in the world.
It did, because you're sacrificing yourself for it's a whole thing, but we'll talk about it here shortly. Yeah. And then I wasn't really like entrenched to anything until we get to the underworld. So we'll go ahead and talk about the retrieval of the shield.
Firstly, I do want to point out the scene in the Arch. I am glad that, again, with Raiden stepping in with the writing credits, because in the book, he just pretty much falls directly from the Arch into the water. And as someone who lives in Missouri and has been to the Arch on many occasions, you know that while the Arch is next to the river, there is no way, demigod or not, you are going to fall and or jump from the top of the Arch and make it into the river. There's just way too much of a difference. So I'm glad that we got the inclusion of this sort of water spout thing that launches up and grabs him and pulls him into the water. Makes a lot more sense. Because, yeah, it's just like, if you're going to tell me that kid's going to jump and make it into the water, you are insane.
Hey, gotta suspend belief sometimes.
Very true. I did also like the portrayal of Echidna in that scene, how she was constantly nice, pretending to be nice, very sweet. Love the design of the Chimera. Very cool.
Yes, it was. It did come off very nice.
But yes, we have our scene in the theme park. This is a complete deviation from the book. So they encounter Ares, and can we just say casting Adam Copeland as Ares was an genius move.
I was not expecting that, but I was very pleasantly surprised to see him cast as Ares, because he gives that God of War kind of aura. So that was very, very great casting, especially when you get to the final fight.
I'm not currently a huge wrestling fan, but I was when Copeland, who went by the stage name Edge, was on the show, and I loved him, and I thought he was just so funny. He's one of those really great wrestling actors who is able to play both a face and a heel so well, because he just, even when he's playing a face, he's just got this very smarmy attitude. You just want to boo him. And that is exactly the kind of attitude we want to see with the God of War. I mean, there's just the scene when they sit down in the restaurant, the, and he's on his phone, and he's starting a Twitter war. And I'm just like, oh my sweet God. Of course, the God of War would be a freaking Twitter troll. Why am I not surprised? Yeah. That was hilarious.
And he just says, hold on, I've got to do that. And it's just something that you would honestly see. And if you just see no Adam Copeland's personality, you could just see him doing that in his everyday life anyway. Just being himself, because he's a very big practical jokester. Super nice guy.
I've seen the interviews. He is super polite. He is a great guy to his fans.
Yeah, super nice guy. I met him in Charleston, West Virginia once. Ran into him, super nice guy. He goes out of his way for his fans. And he is legitimately one of the biggest pranksters you'll ever come across. Him and Jay both, which everybody knows as Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them are huge jokesters and pranksters, and they love pranking people, and they will go out of their way to prank you. So doing stuff like that, just see, and that's basically his personality turned up to 11, him playing the God of War.
So he tasks our heroes with retrieving his shield, which has been taken by Hephaestus. And Again, one of the changes here is that he essentially says, I don't trust you not to get my shield and run off, so Grover's going to stay with me here in the diner, which is interesting because they warn him, like, don't let him get in your mind. He's the god of war. He's going to screw with you. Because in the book, they mention about how just being in his presence makes you angrier, more emotional, more violent. Because again, that is what the god of war does. He would want to get you riled up, want to make you fight.
Yeah, kind of hanging out like doing a podcast with Winfrey on a regular basis.
Sure, why not?
Winfrey will make you want to fight somebody.
Now there's someone else on the network that does that to me, but I'm not dropping names.
We won't say anything about Pat.
I didn't drop the name. You did. So, but yeah. So Grover stays, and he manages to actually get inside Ares' head through flattery. I just love a little bit. He was actually talking about, you know, getting on his side about Athena, and Ares like, yes, oh my God, no one gets it. I love that. And essentially manages to wiggle out some information from him about who the actual Lightning Thief is. Meanwhile, Annabeth and Percy go to this amusement park where they go in to get the shield. And the trap is, this is a callback to another classic Greek myth. Hephaestus had built Hera this beautiful throne. And the minute she sat down on it, she could not move. She couldn't get back up. To which Hephaestus says, I will only release you if you give me Aphrodite. As we all know, even though Aphrodite was off running around with Ares, she was married to Hephaestus, so Hera agreed, and he let her out of the trap. So the throne is there, and the idea is that you have two people. One person has to sit there and essentially sacrifice themselves to the throne, and then the shield will fall, and then the other one can get it. And Percy decides to play the martyr card and sits down on it, and the shield is released. And then Hephaestus walks in, and Annabeth gives this plea to him saying, we don't want the family drama. We just want to do what is right. And she gets to him, and he agrees and releases them. But for me, I thought it was kind of weird because the idea of that trap, it's specifically for the shield. Ares is the only one who would go for that shield. And I can't help but feel like the only person who would go with him would be Aphrodite. It's like, did Hephaestus know that Ares was going to send these two kids in to get a shield for him? It's a cool idea, and I like the idea of one person has to sacrifice themselves for the others to go on, but it feels a little convoluted.
Well, you got to think, Ares is also egomaniac and very egotistical, so anybody that would go with him, he would have to sacrifice to get the shield. So he's not going to sacrifice himself, so if anybody went in with him, it's going to be Aphrodite, which is the main goal. So he would have to sacrifice Aphrodite to get his shield back. Wherein lies, Aphrodite would always be there forever. So that was the goal, is it was going to be a plan to trap Aphrodite forever, because he knew Ares would never give himself up. He would always have to sacrifice someone else.
Again, not against it. It just felt a little forced for me. Mine are also a little nitpick. I think they could have done a lot more with the makeup and the costuming on Hephaestus.
Yeah.
Because if you know...
I think they went too basic.
Yeah, if you know the legend, you know Hephaestus is horribly disfigured because he basically got yeeted off of Mount Olympus. There's no other way to put it. And he's broken, and he's got a limp, and even all that, he's still the god of craftsmanship. And this actor, he looks good and everything, and I could see him being a craftsman, but at the same time, like, really? You don't even have him with, like, on a crutch or
he had a cane, didn't he?
You know what? He's standing behind a railing. If there was a cane, I couldn't see it.
Yeah, I think he has a cane. I think he has a cane because he turns and walks out with a cane. When he leaves, he's got a cane.
Again, I couldn't see it. If he did, I might be wrong. But even with the cane, I feel they could have done a little bit more with this. Again, it was so much of the story of what Hephaestus has gone through. I think we could have had a lot more fun with that. And speaking of costuming and how things really didn't, you know, it's like, wow, really, is that what you went with? Next episode, we end up in the Lotus Casino and run into Lin-Manuel Miranda, who I am 90% sure just walked onto the set and said, hey, can I be in this scene?
And this is probably the low point for me, this episode. I think they rushed this cameo because in the book, he does not make the appearance till later on in the series.
Yeah, book 2 or 5, I think.
I think it's in Sea of Monsters. I know it's in the Sea of Monsters movies when we come across him. I think I read when I was doing the research it's toward the middle or end of Sea of Monsters in the book.
Yeah, but there's a lot. Yeah, that's right. It's Hephaestus who in the books doesn't show up until book 5. Yeah, they dropped him early as well. In the books, he was not. Again, that whole trap was not in the book. So
yeah, and I think that they kind of rushed this because they're trying to expedite the timeline to hurry up. It's basically hurry up and get us to point A, point B. Just trying to hit the hits as well as get some of the more well-known gods or name recognition in there. Because in the book, they just stop at the Lotus Hotel and to rest, and they don't
Go ahead.
Yeah, they don't really realize what's going on until they get ready to leave, and it's like 3 days later.
Again, that goes back to what I was talking about with the whole thing with Medusa. These characters go in and they know the story of the Lotus Eaters. Now, I do give credit that we didn't go with, okay, I'm going to just say it. I know in the movie they actually have the Lotus cookies, candies. I don't know what those things are.
Yes, like lotus petals or something.
Yeah, something made of wax sugar, I'm sure. But
lotus
they
crack or something, I don't know.
It's kind of, okay, so we know the story of the Lotus Eaters. In the original book, they just show up in the Lotus Casino. Yeah, originally they are not told, get to the Lotus Casino and find Hermes. Grover and the animals in the truck stage a breakout. That part was real. That part was in the book. I almost said the part was real. I'm like, yeah, that really happened. I need to get my wording
straight. Grover and the zebras.
Which honestly sucks because the title of the episode is, what was it? It was like something, we take a zebra to Vegas. The freaking zebra shows up for like 1 second in the background. You focus more on the camel.
So
they crash and they're like, where do we crash? Oh, we're in Vegas. Okay, well, I guess we need to clean up. Oh, hey, there's a casino over here, let's go in it again. And that again is going back to what I was talking about with Medusa. I hated that these characters go into the Lotus Casino and they automatically say, remember the legend of the Lotus Eaters, don't eat or drink anything. You know, it's like, we don't need them to not eat the candies or anything like they did in the movie. But I don't like that they know what's going on before they go in. I really feel like it just kicks out a lot of suspense and intrigue. Not to mention, I love Percy kind of gaining awareness of what's going on because he's playing a video game with a guy who starts using 1970s vernacular. And if you look in this episode, you see people dressed in clothing from a lot of different time periods. And frankly, I'm just going to say, it doesn't make sense for Hermes to run a casino like that. He's the god of, I know he's the god of tricksters, but he's also the god of travelers. In the Greek legends, he's the one who bails guys out of the Lotus Casino. So I don't know why he would run that.
He owns a FedEx.
That made sense. That made all the sense in the world, and I loved seeing him delivering the Medusa head. That was funny.
Yeah, he owns FedEx. So just for future reference, Hermes owns FedEx. That will be on your bingo card. But
it's
yeah,
canon now.
But yeah, having him in the Lotus Hotel, I think was kind of shoehorned in. But it's basically trying to hurry up and, you know, hit plot points because they look at it as, you know, it's Hermes. He can provide a quick basically a fast travel for all of our video game nerds. Fast travel.
I'm
going to
go with instant transmission for all of you anime nerds.
So that's what happens. And it's really weird because Grover gets caught in this this loop, and the problem solves itself, and that's what I didn't like, and that's why I think this was a low point, because you have the problem, and then it's just like they know the problem, they figure the problem out, and within like two scenes, the problem's resolved. There's no, like you said, there's no gravitas of peril, of time loss, or anything, which we'll talk about, you know, time being lost makes no sense because the mission anyway. We'll talk about that as we wrap up. But yeah, it's kind of like, They shoehorned Hermes in here for no particular reason except to have him appear.
Yeah, I mean, it. With all fairness, if their argument is solely we have Lin-Manuel Miranda, we're going to use Lin-Manuel Miranda, then I can't fight that. Because Lin-Manuel Miranda is awesome.
True.
I still say, though, based on what he was wearing, though, he just walked onto the set that day and asked.
Yeah, he probably was just in the area and it was like, hey, we're going to put you in this scene. He's like, okay, do I need to go to wardrobe? No, what you're wearing is fine.
No, the hoodie's fine. A hoodie that is clearly three sizes too big for you is fine. That was a huge hoodie.
So,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, so they take the taxi, they don't end up in the underworld just yet. They end up on the outskirts.
Santa Monica. Percy got I think it wasn't supposed to be a premonition, but I think he was told that by the Nereid? Is that how you pronounce the water spirit?
Yeah.
Nereid?
Yeah, he's supposed to meet his dad in Santa Monica.
Yeah, so he goes in and finds the Nereid again, and she basically says, yeah, guess what? You failed.
Yeah, you're late. Your dad left.
Yeah, he's going to war.
And milk. He went out for cigarettes and milk.
I always heard cigarettes and Pop-Tarts.
So
the Nereid gives them the pearls that will get them out of the underworld. And
so they find out that in this instance, they find out that Percy's mom's not actually dead. She's in the underworld with Hades. Hades is keeping his mom in the underworld. She's not actually dead.
There's a difference between half, you know, partly dead and all dead.
Yeah. So,
sorry, there is never a bad time for a Princess Bride reference.
They're going to travel to the underworld, rescue Percy's mom, and then continue on with the mission.
Percy essentially says, look, I don't care that the deadline is passed. This is my quest. I'm going to see it through. Again, a deviation from the book in which they did lose quite a few days in the Lotus Casino.
Well,
but they were still able to complete their deadline.
Yeah, the deadline doesn't pass until after the battle with Ares.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, after they go to the underworld, they meet Hades, which I touched on this earlier. We get the Harry Potter reference, which when you meet Severus, Which is a giant deviation from the book. In the book, Annabelle actually makes friends and basically turns it into her pet, to the point where Severus howls as they're leaving for Annabelle to come back to visit. But that's how they get away from it. But for some reason, and there's a big difference through Percy Jackson and Harry Potter, there was a big article written up about how it differed from Harry Potter. Well, then you get the shot, basically the shot for shot escape for Severus from the Harry Potter that you see here.
I gotta ask, why do they always do Cerberus as a Rottweiler?
Because basically it is, there's a reasoning behind it. Speaking of which,
I was gonna say, can you imagine if this, if
I don't have a Cerberus.
I was gonna say, but yeah, wouldn't it be cute if Cerberus looked like that?
I do. Corgi, yeah. But I do have a Fluffy though.
Aw, is that Fang?
Yeah.
Aw, that's cute.
Yeah, I got Fang. I got him this year at Universal.
So nice.
He came home with me. So
I have researched how to make this costume for Eddie.
I would totally not doubt that you will make that costume. But yeah, so you get basically the shot for shot escape from Severus, which I found kind of funny for the lengths that they went to separate themselves from Harry Potter. And then we meet Hades. Hades in the movie was portrayed as this villain, which he is in a lot of movies. Hades portrayed as the devil and the villain, which Hollywood loves to do that, and it's not who Hades is. And you kind of find out that Hades is, like we've mentioned before, is content being left alone in the underworld.
Yeah, this is something that really annoys me. Again, I give a pass to the Disney Hercules portrayal of Hades because James Woods just nailed that role and it was great. And he is the soul saving grace of that entire movie. But you have so many, there's so many versions of Hades that they're like God of the underworld. Oh, Satan. So annoying. Yeah. Because, yeah, so many of the legends, like, no, Hades is just, and a lot of times I actually will have people pointing out, it's like, okay, he's God of the underworld, so he actually has a vastly larger kingdom than Zeus and Poseidon will ever have. He's God of the underworld riches, so he's wealthier than they'll ever be. They point out multiple times that he has all the access to all the precious minerals and gems and whatever, and he's got a smoking hot wife. Persephone.
Yeah. You know? And when they're talking and, you know, Percy's talking to him and he just basically, and like Percy finds out that we find out who the big bad is. And when, you know, Grover about gets swallowed up. So, and Percy thinks Hades is the one who set him up by taking the bolt, because Percy finds the bolt in his backpack that Hermes gave him. And he kind of starts putting two and two together, and then he goes on this big tirade, and Hades is like, huh? What are you talking about?
There's always a humor to that when a character gives what is clearly a prepared speech, and the person they're giving the speech to just looks at him like, none of that matters. Because Hades basically, it turns out that Electo the Harpy went after him not because of the bolt. Hades was under the impression that Percy had his helm of darkness.
His helm of darkness, yeah.
Yeah. His fancy hat.
That was used to steal the bolt.
Yeah. And it's just, and he's basically says, like, look, I just want my lucky hat back, okay? And they strike a deal, and because his mother, or Percy's mother, is there, and Percy says, look, I'm going to go get your lucky hat, and then when it's returned to you, you release my mom. And they get out of there, and they wash up back on the beach, where they, it's not the beach, it's not Santa Monica, it's Montauk. It's where
it's the beach house that him and his mom always went to, mm-hmm. Because that's where she actually met Poseidon.
Well, guess who's waiting there on the beach? It's not Poseidon. It's Ares, and Edge looks like he's ready to throw down.
Yeah, and going back real quick to touch on something about Hades is one. The underworld looks phenomenal. It is basically Olympus upside down.
The giant stone ceiling or the giant stone sky with the stalagmites. I not a geology scholar. I always get those two terms mixed up. I'm sorry.
But it goes into something that, you know, we was talking about. I said we touch on when we got to Hades is Hades was banished from Mount Olympus. But in this, he says he just chooses not to go back. But in reality, Hades was banished because of the rivalries with his brothers. He was cast out. He was forbidden to come back to Mount Olympus. And it harbors a lot of hurt and resentment for Hades. That's why he is the way he is. But he's also happy to be rid of all the drama that the gods are known for. Mm-hmm. He is happy in the underworld. He has self-satisfaction. And like you said, he has everything. He has a bigger kingdom than Olympus would ever be with a vast amount of riches. But, and the way it's portrayed is you kind of see, it comes across as he actually shows emotion for being exiled. And you see the kind of hurt that he has being exiled from his family, which is really interesting. Then we get to the fight with Ares, which Percy basically says, you know, we're gonna go one on one. He says, I want to go one on one with the Great One.
Go for first blood. There's
blood.
A wrestling reference in there somewhere. I do not know how to go there. For the record, I'm with you on the portrayal of the underworld, except for one thing, and that is the portrayal of Asphodel, the forest that they have to walk through. In Greek mythology, Asphodel is essentially what I think some people would call purgatory. It is the meh. If you do not want to be judged, if you are too scared, essentially, to get judged, or you don't want to wait to get judged, you can go to Asphodel. In the books, it's like standing in a field of wheat in Kansas for all eternity. I've spent more of my fair share of my life in Kansas, and I can tell you, I think that sounds worse than Tartarus. But the idea of these humans combined into trees is very much so more of the seventh circle from Dante's Inferno, where harm to oneself, the forest of the souls who committed suicide.
Uh-huh.
And I was just like, that's not Asphodel. That is literally the seventh circle. Again, it's like, I don't know why they changed it like that, except to split Annabeth away from the group. And again, I don't know why that was necessary.
Well, it gives Annabeth a reason, because the roots show regret. And that's something that you see, and I don't remember it touching on it, what her regret is.
But I think it's from staying away from her family. Because she ran away from home because the family dynamic with her father and her stepmother was just not working for her, essentially. We don't know a lot about what that meant, just that she ran away from home. And because it is a big thing at the end when she says she's going to go reconnect with her dad.
Yeah. So we get the fight with Ares, which is really interesting, especially the visuals of the tidal wave that he uses to help defeat Ares. And then we find out the true villain is Kronos.
Who is not dead, but has been,
granddaddy.
Yeah, he is the father of the gods, the last of the Titans. And much like a certain other big bad in a young adult series, has been biding his time until he can come back to life and take his revenge. Yeah, there is no way to avoid the Harry Potter parallels here.
Yeah, next thing we know, we're going to start talking about Horcruxes.
I nearly brought up Horcruxes when we were talking about Ares and the idea that when the more you're around him, the angrier you get. I'm like, okay, so he's a god Horcrux.
Yeah, so... And then after he beats Ares, Ares says, "You've got an enemy for life." And then they find out, they agree that they've missed the deadline. This is when they decide, they realize that they've missed the deadline. They gives Hades his fancy hat back.
They give it to Electo.
And
they say, okay, here. Tell Hades we expect him to keep up his end of the bargain.
Percy goes to Olympus, which the visuals on Olympus was outstanding.
Very much Olympus, so. Kind of reminded me of the final level in Kingdom Hearts 3. Still very nice.
And then we see a tragic moment. In one of the best castings, but in a tragic way, we meet Zeus.
Lance Reddick's final role. Rest in peace, Mr. Reddick. You were awesome.
And I think that this role, he could have thrived in this role because he just has that presence to be a god among men.
Very much I have all the power. You don't know what you're dealing with. Get the hell out of my sight. He just has the way he talks to Percy, the way he looks at him, is the way a human looks at an ant.
Especially when he's telling him, "Thanks for the information. Now be gone. I'm letting you live." And Percy keeps talking, and when he shouts, and you have the thunder and lightning in the background, That was awesome. That was an amazing just scene, because he comes off, he has this sophistication to him, but he also has this menace that he can play a really nice guy, but he has that menace that he can play an amazing villain that we've seen him play a villain on various occasions. And just when he yells and that thunder and lightning's in the background and just his voice comes across, and it's like he was taken way too soon, especially out of this when playing such a perfect Zeus in this role.
Definitely. You know, a lot of people thought he was, when they heard he was cast, but they didn't announce who he was cast as, they thought he was going to be Hades.
See, I wouldn't have seen him as Hades. I don't think he would have been a good Hades.
No, I think he does fit the role perfectly. And tragically, this is his final performance. And we get to see Percy essentially saying, "I'm not leaving until you acknowledge this." And Zeus is saying, "It's like, you know, I've killed like people for being more annoying than you." Nearly strikes him down, and guess who finally swoops in to save his son?
His daddy.
Poseidon, played by Toby Stevens.
And which I think is I like the costuming of this because you have him show up in that like a sea foam shirt.
In the book, he was actually wearing Bermuda. I was saying the book, he's wearing Bermuda shorts and a shirt that looks like it got taken out of a Margaritaville staff member. I will say I'm really glad they portrayed the gods wearing modern clothing. It's a minor thing, but I'm always a little annoyed whenever we see Greek gods in modern day scenarios and they're still all wearing like the togas and stuff. It's like, guys, we can have more fun with this. We can be more creative. You know, again, you got Ares in that huge leather coat. You've got did I say Ares or Hades? Ares in the big leather. You got Hades in that slick black suit. And yeah, you have Zeus in that, well, I'm just going to call it very powerful looking suit and tie.
Yeah.
So again, I'm glad that they avoided that. I always hate it. It's just like, don't need to see another Greek god in a toga. And yeah, Poseidon essentially says, there's not going to be any war because I surrender. You don't have an opponent. And yeah, Zeus is like, well, can't really go to war with somebody if they ain't going to fight.
Yeah, so then you see Poseidon actually calls out Zeus for everybody knowing that Cronus is still alive.
Yeah, I love it. It's like, who else knows about this? And I love it. It's what it was like. The minute he gets to, he's like, it's Ares, Hades, and Hermes. And I think it's when he gets to Hermes, like, oh, so everyone. It's like, oh, great. The family gossip knows. Because you know Hermes would be the family gossip.
Yeah. So, and then it's like, so you find out Cronus is there. Cronus is the big bad. You have this really heart to heart. And then Poseidon sends Percy back to Camp Half-Blood where he's being celebrated, and we find the big reveal of who betrays Percy.
The person who actually stole the bolt. And it's one who did call him friend, Luke. Okay, now going off again of the first movie, I really like the performance and how they portrayed Luke in this one. Luke is a son of Hermes, and he is essentially, he is fed up with the gods. He's like, the Greek gods keep fathering all these demigods, and we're left to try to save ourselves when you got all these monsters coming after us, and they're not helping us. We've talked about this before on the show. The Greek gods are assholes. They do not care about human affairs, even when it's their own children. And Luke is just fed up with this, and he has been manipulated by Cronos, who saw him as easy prey. Now, in the first film, I thought that Luke was portrayed too much of a just an asshole. He just comes across as a bully, I've been around long enough, I know what I'm talking about. Luke here genuinely seems hurt. He is just so upset that, you know, his father has never been there for him. He's upset because, again, Hermes' cabin is also the cabin where the unclaimed go. And it's never really specifically pointed out, but it's hinted at by Chiron, the centaur, that there have been demigods who have been in there for years, and their godparent has never claimed them.
Right.
So you get the idea that he has seen so many of these kids come in here and be like, I don't know who my godparent, I don't know who my father/mother is. I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't know how to help. He really feels that the gods have let them down. He feels betrayed by them. This isn't a bravado, bullying, jerky move. He's not, he doesn't want to be the villain. He doesn't want to be the bad guy. He thinks he's doing the right thing. And I really felt they played him well with that.
Yeah. And the best villains are the ones that think they're in the right. And I think this is where they played Luke best. You don't really see Luke being the true asshole in the movies until the second movie. That's when you see him, because he, at the beginning of the second movie, he gives Percy all these things. He, you know, he's like, what do you need? And he's got all this, like, he's got shoes and all these electronics and stuff. But in the series, you actually feel that there's a friendship, because you have the flashbacks of him mentoring Percy throughout his time at Camp Half-Blood.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes the reveal tug at your heartstrings a little bit more, because he is actually he was one of the first people Percy met and took Percy under his wing, only to betray him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think I think this does actually point out an important fact, and that is we have not gotten a single word yet about season two of this. Obviously, we got a lot more books to adapt, and the actors have all said they're up for it, but I could not find anything about whether or not season two has gotten a green light yet or not. I assumed a lot of us thought maybe they had delayed that because of the Writers Guild strike, that maybe they just weren't able to work on it. But you would think by now, especially with the glowing reviews this series got, we would have gotten something by now confirming if there was going to be a second season or not.
Yeah, it hasn't been renewed as of yet. But it looks like it will. It's doing really good. So it's going to be, I think one of the major hangup is they're looking to see who's going to fill the Lance Reddy role as Zeus, because he plays a decent role, if I'm not mistaken, in the second book, as a certain thing happens to the entrance of Camp Half-Blood.
You know, if I had to pick a replacement, I'd go with Keith David.
You know who they should get?
Who would you pick?
Give me Dave Chappelle.
Dave
Chappelle is Zeus.
Okay, you have to explain now.
I mean, would that not be a great Zeus? I mean, it'd be funny as hell.
That it would.
I mean, we could always go with Jonathan Majors. I mean, he ain't doing nothing right now.
Ow. I'm pretty sure Disney has washed their hands of Mr. Majors.
I think his schedule freed up.
That's just like all levels of evil, and you know it.
Yeah, that's funny.
Didn't say it wasn't, but I'm standing by that it's evil.
Mike Tyson as Zeus. He's got the presence, just don't let him talk. Just let somebody else talk for him.
Yeah, let's fire my thunderbolt.
I mean, if you see Mike Tyson on Mount Olympus, it'd be intimidating.
It'd be a good Super Bowl ad.
But one last thing I want to touch on is something that the books don't really touch on, is the expanded story of Percy's mother. I think this did a really good job of expanding on her role in Percy's life. I think it did a really good job of showing how she was actually looking out for Percy. The book, the movie doesn't touch on it hardly at all. You see her in until she gets vaporized, sent to the underworld. But the through the flashbacks and everything, you get to see the relationship really fleshed out. And I think it's something that gives this series a lot of heart and shows that she was actually grooming Percy to be the hero that he's going to be. And the interaction between her and Poseidon, especially in the restaurant, shows that there was a genuine connection to the point where they can't even look at each other because the feelings are so strong.
Very much so. I will also say I did like our little post-credit scene at the end with the stepfather Gabe. In the book, okay, we all know that Gabe was going to get turned to stone. In the books, it's actually implied that Percy's mother pretty much killed him, which in the books, he's less verbal and a lot more physical. Yeah. And so they had to tone that down. So obviously, they couldn't have her killing him, but this time it's the gods send back Medusa's head with a freaking return to sender stamp on it. And Gabe is just so ticked off at his now soon to be ex-wife and ex-stepson that he opens the package for no other reason, just for no reason, just purely out of spite. And he gets 420'd. And I love that.
And it's in the, I don't think it's in, she kills him. I think in the book, he gets turned to stone as well. And she sells the sculpture for money to help start a new life with Percy.
Exactly.
If I'm not mistaken.
It is, but basically Percy gives her the head covered and says, next time Gabe backs up, use this. And yeah, she uses it on him, but yeah, it's still the fact that she knew what was going to happen when she pulled the head out on him. It's like, yeah, dead. So again, I like the idea of Gabe being hoisted by his own petard, as it were.
But any last things that we have not covered in the past hour and a half?
Yeah, this went a little longer than I thought it was going to. So this is, it is a really good series. I'm not going to lie, it's a little slow to start. You know, it takes like, I think an episode or two for you to really start to get in and appreciate things. But it is really good. For the most part, it is a very faithful adaptation. There's a handful of changes we talked about here and a couple things that we thought didn't make any sense other than, again, we have Lin-Manuel Miranda. We're going to use Lin-Manuel Miranda. But this was still very good. I would recommend it highly for fans of the book series or fans of Greek mythology in general. Hopefully we will be getting a second season because the rest of these books are great. And with, again, this has gotten a lot of really positive reception from critics and fans alike, and they want to see more. So hopefully Disney will announce soon that they're working on Sea of Monsters, book two.
I'm really hoping that we get that announcement soon. I think that with all the L's Disney's taken, I think this is one of the bright spots. So I look for us to get an announcement. Well, probably this spring at the latest.
Possibly. Doesn't help. And again, this is another part of the problem with casting such young actors and why they do tend to cast older actors to play them is that these kids are not going to be kids for very long. You know, this is supposed to take place on a yearly basis. Again, very similar to Harry Potter, and the shooting schedule, it's not going to take long before Walker Scobell no longer looks like a 12-year-old, and he's going to look like an 18-year-old trying to play a 15-year-old, because that's just the way time works, and that's how long it takes to make these series.
And then we're back to Beverly Hills 90210, when you got 30-year-olds playing high school kids.
Pretty much. All right, so, yeah, Disney, you don't have a lot of time here. Chop, chop. Get back to work. Stop firing everyone.
Well, I don't have anything else to say that we haven't already covered.
I think we're good. Why don't you go ahead and give us your plugs?
All right. As always, here it's February, the Red Legion Broadcasting Network. So me and Mark are doing our annual It Can't Be Black History Without Two White Guys Talking About Black History. Last week we did a triple feature of The Blackening, Black Christmas, and Meet the Blacks. Go back and listen to that in the archives and see if you can figure out which one does not fit. I'll give you a hint. It is a holiday.
One of these things is not like the other one. One of these things just doesn't belong.
This week is our biopic and our Women of Black History music, where we're covering Respect, the Aretha Franklin story, What's Love Got to Do with It, Tina Turner, and I Want to Dance with Somebody, the Whitney Houston story, which is kind of outside my wheelhouse. Next week, I think it's next Tuesday, we have the triple feature of Richard Pryor doing Bruce's Million, The Toy and Car Wash. The 20th, we have something I'm really looking forward to, me and Mark both. We're doing Hustle and Flow, Black Snake Moan, and we're tackling The Wiz, which is the Diana Ross, Michael Jackson version of Wizard of Oz. And we finish out our Black History Month with one of my favorite movies. And if you've been a fan of the Rattlers Broadcasting Network for very long, you've heard Don't Be a Menace to South Central While Drinking Your Juice in the Hood, referenced many times. I'm going to get you, sucker, and we're finishing up with How High, as we always finish up with a good comedy thing to go out with a bang for Black History. And that will be Wednesday the 28th.
Are you coming on for our Damn You Hollywood of Lisa Frankenstein on the 12th?
I can.
All right, because... Yeah, forgive me. Mark told me to get a hold of Dorian. I think he said he got a hold of Robert. I think there was a miscommunication on which one of us was to get a hold of you. So I apologize if I was supposed to contact you earlier. But yeah, we're doing the Unholy Trinity plus one is getting back together again. I was actually joking with Dorian about how we don't rename since it's now four of us. I'm like, no, there's something very Douglas Adams-esque about keeping it the Unholy Trinity even when it's four people. So, yes.
Just send me the invite so I know to go see it this weekend.
You got it. Yes, we will be taking a look at Lisa Frankenstein, the new horror comedy written by Diablo Cody and directed by Zelda Williams in her directorial debut. We're looking forward to that. Afterwards, on Valentine's Day, I will be leading another TV party tonight to discuss Amazon Prime's biggest hit so far has been Hotel. Those of you who follow my show, my shows and my appearances, you know that I talk so much about that show and how much I love it and how much I love the creator Vivian Medrano. So really looking forward to be talking about that. It's going to be me, Jesse Starcher, and David Wright. After that, I don't know what else I've got until we got something at the end of the month. Mr. Mark Rattledge, Robert Winfrey, and I will be coming together to do a special Damn You Hollywood on February 27th, in which we will be discussing the 2024 Best Picture for the Oscars contenders. We're going to be talking about the 10 films that have been nominated for Best Picture, and we're going to be discussing which ones we think have the best shot. I still need to get it on the schedule, but I will be doing a separate video, fingers crossed, hopefully this works out, on the 5 films that have been nominated for Best Animated Feature. I say fingers crossed because my usual go-to anime sidekick sadly had to drop out. So I have been reaching out to some other folks, see if we can get another guest in on this show. And I've been talking to someone who I need to get back to them and see if this is something they really want to do. So hopefully we'll get that on the schedule very soon. And now on to the plugs that I actually, you know, put a little more time into because they pay my bills. My company, Honeysuckle Rose Creations, where fashion meets fandom at the intersection of geek and chic, purveyors of awesome handmade geek-themed jewelry upcycled from various game pieces, including, let me do a little quick search here, including our Camp Half Bloodline. We've got earrings and we have a charm bracelet. The charm bracelet, which is not showing up on that page. I really hate that Etsy opens a new tab for everything. So I'm just going to have to point around it here because I don't want to have to go through putting in another page on this screen. Is inspired by the necklaces worn by the campers at Camp Half-Blood. Those familiar with the books, you know that the campers wear a necklace with beads and each bead is decorated with a themed event of the year. So we have all of the events that we see take place in the Percy Jackson universe, including, you can see it right there at the top, that is the bead that that is created during the Lightning Thief. That, of course, is the appearance of the Trident. Go ahead and close that up. Now, we are still in our off period before we start going back to the convention circuit, but we are getting ready for that. Looking forward to our first show, Planet Comic Con. It's here in Kansas City. That is our home show. We have so many awesome guests coming in. I just found out we are going to have the cast of Fairly Odd Parents. That's Darren Norris, Susan Blankensley, I always mispronounce her name, and Miss Tara Strong. We are going to have a Scream reunion with Skeet Ulrich, Matthew Lillard, Jamie Kennedy. They just announced that Neve Campbell sadly had to drop out, but we got Henry Winkler, who played the principal in the first movie, so he's going to be there. And we got freaking Ron Perlman, the king. I love it when he comes to these cons. I love seeing him there. So if you are in the Midwest, come check that out. It's going to be awesome. And yes, we will be there with not only the stuff that you see here on this page, but a lot of other fun pieces as well. Some which I am still working on creating because I love to make stuff for events. And I'm also a glutton for punishment and have a tendency to make something less than a week before an event because that's when inspiration strikes, because that is my cross to bear. Mm-hmm. Other than that, we do also have our shop on Handmade at Amazon, and you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, fuck you Elon Musk, I will never call it X, and TikTok. That's Honeysuckle Rose Creations, the intersection of geek and chic. So for myself, for Mr. Jason Teasley, who, by the way, when I wrote in your name in the description, you changed the spelling of your name to something a little more Greek. I put that spelling in the description as well. So it's going to come up as TZ. Okay. Just letting you know. All right. Thank you for joining us. Have a wonderful evening. And remember, we don't get paid enough for this.